Well, you asked me to do something that is more maybe practice-based, and as I'm not having any institutional affiliation right now, but have been running through a lot of institutions within the media, within academia and art institutions, I think my approach to this topic is less structural and institutional questions that I'm going to bring up, but in how far a very particular niche of practice, I'm talking about biomedia art, can provide examples of how they fit in and create feedback loops in different contexts. And therefore, I will start from very general questions and get down to very, very precise content. And then you have to stop me if you think that it's too detailed and it's not going anywhere, but it's going to be the other way around. Let's see. And my contribution to this symposium is based on a, I would say, threefold scope of interest and practices. The first step was when I was, prior to my long-standing engagement with the European cultural channel Arte, I was part of the team that created the channel in 92. I had studied and accomplished a degree in scientific and technological journalism at the University of Tours, and therefore I was generally and genuinely interested in strategies of knowledge transmission. So this was my prior interest. And then, after years of that I've lost with audiovisual media practice, when I switched to curating, in fact, 10 years later, my main focus on technology-based art always implies forms of artistic research, which, and as you are stating with the conference statement, you say, sparks important innovative impulses for the sciences by systematically questioning their thematic, methodological, and epistemological preconceptions. And in other words, for me, this unfolds very often in stressing what I called the inherent media blindness within the science, and to create friction, like you call it, friction energy between the different areas of scientific, artistic, and social practice. So the third step then was when returning back to academia and to teaching at the Institute of Media Studies at Ruhr Universität in Bochum in 2007, I became aware of how appropriate many examples that I have been supporting as a curator, but also learning about through festivals, jury work, and so on, including those I'm going to talk about, that means artworks that are based on biotechnologies as tools of presence rather than as represented scientific objects, that there were teaching topics very, very appropriated for interdisciplinarity, transdisciplinarity, biomediality, which I'm going to discuss, and I used them as a litmus test to reveal paradigmatic shifts toward a conception of media in general beyond their communication-bound understanding that is still coming from physics and that is moving to biology, as it is my impression right now. So I felt that there was a huge potential to connect with other disciplines, and that is really largely neglected, and that even colleagues making friends at the physics, biology, medicine, or engineering faculty are really the exception, and that crossing the campus at Ruhr Universität, for example, it's very easy, but actually people don't do it. And people don't go to the engineering department and learn about systems chemistry, while there's a whole scope of metaphors that is being discussed there just 100 meters from us, and we still discuss this more or less in a single faculty that we call interdisciplinary, like it's the media studies. So we do interdisciplinary research in our own discipline, in a certain way, which is not that much interdisciplinary, by just sucking topics and concepts from other disciplines, but not talking to them. And so within the realm of the questions raised at this symposium, I will first formulate some general questions about impulses that we may expect from transversal and artistic input in academic context, and then to try to demonstrate the larger scope of potential research questions generated by two chosen case studies from the two exhibitions I curated earlier this year. So one exhibition, I have forgotten the book, I will bring it tomorrow, was called Fingerprints with Paul Van Noos, an artist based in Buffalo, New York, and that it was a deconstruction of the genetic fingerprint, and I will give this as a second case studies. And the first exhibition, the other one, was Synthetic, that was a larger exhibition at the Natural History Museum in Vienna earlier this week, this year, about the connections between art and synthetic biology. So I've chosen the title Epistemological Biomedia, Epistemic Art, with the intention to inquire what an apparently emerging epistemic turn after the linguistic, the pictorial, and the performative turn that we all know about would imply. And by epistemological biomedia, understand the use of biological or biotechnological media by artists with a specific aim to not only apply and subvert scientific, techno-scientific apparatuses and display, but to centrally and critically stage the means of production of knowledge themselves, including a fruitful skepticism about different knowledge claims, methods, validity, scope, and producing epistemic art then would not be meant only in the sense of the epistemic relating to knowledge or cognition, but rather to double-check the cultural practices of emphasizing the problem how we know what we know. This is what I call epistemic art here. So when flicking to Andrea's papers in advance through the ambitious descriptions of the Lofene Arts Program, some questions came to my mind. And when it comes to artistic research at the university as a practice, do we mean the artist's need for knowledge? Do we need the discursive framing? Do we mean methods, or do we mean the need for technology? Very often artists come because they need technology, they need a special advice, but does it already is enough to call it art and science collaboration? So the other question is there a need for interdisciplinary infrastructure, and if this is even possible? I mean, the example from my university, where I really saw that you have all the disciplines around, you're not lacking biology, you're not lacking physics, but the very presence doesn't mean that people actually use it. So what does it mean that we have an interdisciplinary infrastructure? Where does it come from? Who generates it and who keeps it going? Who keeps it involved? And if we discuss the relationship between art, science, and the humanities, do we automatically ask about sciences, as we have seen earlier, dominated by the natural science? Is this the science we are talking about? And that art as a cultural practice then would bring them closer to the so-called humanities. So this is again about Geisteswissenschaft and Naturwissenschaft. Very often the art science discourse are very much focused on the natural science. I agree with you. So. And so suppose that art here is expected to, quote Andreas, changes that may make it necessary for universities and art schools to transform and reinvent themselves. Are we looking then at a residency program or academia as a center or institution, or rather as a decentered network of distributed competence? And this implies also question about, do the artist needs to be there? Is the art still remaining when the artist has left? What is the actual art there? I mean, is it something that we can even do at the faculty when so many disciplines are not represented? Another benefit maybe, I mean, how will benefits be reciprocal rather than just be one way? Because you have to convince scientists, and the first question always is, what do I get out of it for my own practice? Is it science visualization? Is it documentation? Is it getting metaphors better or whatever? And which competences are finally that one that artists are seeking for, and which ones are they bringing in? And this is just a silly example, but can scholars prevent artists from discursive, fashionable nonsense when talking about the free-floating elements? I mean, personally, if I receive as a curator an artist paper which starts with Deleuze, I even don't read it anymore. I mean, it goes directly to the trash because it really indicates, you know. And usually if I come to conference and the first sentence is, I'm doing a practice-based PhD, it's probably the key sentence for me to leave the room. I mean, well, Rancière, yeah, it's getting, well, it will be in 10 years you wouldn't read this proposal anymore. there's some thought behind this. I mean, Sokal and Brigmont named this post-modern intellectuals abuse of science, and of course artists are very prone to that as well. Or does rather an artist with interdisciplinary approach prevent the researchers from the humanities from abusive metaphors stemming from mathematics or physics? or the researchers in the natural science from thinking of contemporary art in terms of 19th century aesthetic canons, or might be then even fruitful misunderstanding generate the very energy and friction that we are searching for. How do artists concretely use, abuse, rather than observe or aesthetically translate, transduce, visualize or sonify material structures, processes in experimental systems or techno-scientific entities that Hans-Jörg Reinberger calls epistemic things? I've just listed this because it's funny, it's applying to the life science and how artists with the life science can have a very, very different scope of methods or strategies to go into the lab and to visit a scientific researcher there. And Oren Katz from Symbiotech has established this taxonomy of models of artistic engagement with the life science. So the over-the-shoulder looking artist coming in and being excited about cognitive neurophysiology and being excited and making a sculpture of chewing gum out of it, you know. I'm meeting David Edwards from the Laboratoire in Paris on Monday. And the first exhibition he did was with Fabrice Hubert, and Fabrice Hubert was so excited to learn about stem cells that it was really making even the Air France magazine, right? And he then did very, very nice sculptures with chewing gum, yeah, which was extremely cheesy. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not because you bring a very good researcher together with a very good contemporary artist that in the very old Oberst style, I mean, you make good art or even good processes. You know, I'm critiquing that, and we have a talk with David Edwards on Monday about that. So we have the entertainer, the hoaxster, the mail order artist. Yeah, if you mail order genetic organisms, I mean, and you display them live, it may be biotechnological art, but how far does it go, right? So, and the strategies that Symbiotica is trying to enhance and to emphasize that this may be a good way of doing is the researcher that is embedded in science and in the technological setting. And that's why probably Oren Katz puts this at place number 12.
What is number 13?
Well, I think we go forever, no? So, for several reasons, also then the artistic use of biomedia as means of expression provides fruitful examples of interdisciplinary contamination, and that I'm trying to examine through the lens of a media studies scholar. And in such art, and I think the media studies approach to it is indeed very fruitful, with despite the critique that I was starting with, because mediation and technologies are no longer employed merely to achieve an aesthetic effect, but the media themselves are fully integrated elements in the aesthetic idiom itself. It doesn't start with biotechnology, but of course with computer art, net art, and so on, which is already the case. But features that once unfolded primarily as artistic images or sound, audiovisual combinations are being remediated, dispersed, and fragmented in the confusing multitude of media, and this confusion makes up the aesthetic objects. And I feel that biomedia projects are a very good example for transdisciplinary challenges beyond a purely hermeneutic or image-based approach to it. And I'm quite critical of the image science for this reason. So in the context of the bioscience, we have to ask if do artists just want to make rival use of the epistemic power of the image in an age where the techno-sciences have increasingly become themselves potent producers of aesthetic visualizations themselves? And or do they rather use wetware at the molecular or cellular level in order to short-circuit semiotic procedures and representation and knowledge strategies by staging and emphasizing the very authenticity of the biological subjects, objects, or processes that they are dealing with? So, I mean, is the image still the scope that through which we have to look at art? And this is interesting because this visual analogy is just coming out of the workshop situation that we had in London, and you will find some formal analogy here.
So it is the image.
This is the image, but of course it's second degree use of the image. Right? Okay, then why again it could be interesting for media studies to go more in this direction, because I'm very influenced by Walter Salter's book that probably only few of you know, The Physik der Medien. Can I make this test? Physik der Medien, who knows that? Okay, yeah. I mean, I think it's at least as important, I always exaggerating, but you have read Kittler, you need read Walter Salter, you know, it's evident for me. And Physik der Medien is very much about what in the French context is called médiologie, so it's very close to Régis Debray and so on, but it totally broadens up the very scope of what a medium is. And such projects pave the way for seeing media in a larger sense, and of course I'm going back in all this research to the origin of the terms in physics and biology, to Leo Spitzer's Milieu and Ambiance, this very important essay from 42, and going beyond the digital age understanding of media functions of transmitting, storing and processing, to quote Kittler, of information or audiovisual data, and adding neural capacities to self-repair, adapt, evolve, but beyond the computing level, beyond the dematerialist level. So I distinguish biomedia in three categories. So biomedia first as milieu, just as a kind of enabling condition, which solicits changes in living beings or in organic entities, and like it's done in tissue culture, for example, or cell computing. Second, media in the sense of means of transformation or generation that shift the ability to transmit, store, and process into the biological realms. So we can talk about GMOs, bioinformatics, DNA computing prototypes here. And the third distinction would be media as instances of measure in line with traditional media of perception and analysis, such as optical or other physical instruments, but in which one biological entity is measuring another one. So we have all these three scopes, what media have been traditionally, but more and more migrating to my sense to what I call biomedia. And these biomedia also of great instability, and in this aspect they, unlike earlier media, such monomedia such as film or radio, which were bound to a more stable physical device, they also resemble digital media. That is my thesis. So what I want to say with this is only that the artistic use of biomedia as means of expression also takes advantage of this high degree of believability, truthfulness, aliveness, authenticity, and in this it follows also the mechanism described by Walter and Grusin as remediation, the concept implying that newly introduced media better fulfill the goal of authenticity, presence, and real experience by reforming older media in the name of the real. The next point is that I think that biomedia art, as a niche example I'm going to discuss, also involves different disciplines, at the same time questions the usually mesoscopic and anthropocentric scale of art and stages questions about economy, ecology, sustainability, both at the micro and the macro scale. I've chosen this diagram from Nina Cegledi and Roman Guardians that have proposed this graphic within the topic of artists in extreme environments, but the extremes are not hot temperatures or unfriendly jungles here, but rather time and scale. And in this diagram, despite the very large scope opened by technology and media-based art, all is quite concentrated in this very small bubble, which represents the mesoscopic scale of organisms, of course, with the human reference point in the middle. So in how far does this kind of art that is very addressing the very, very microscopic with very huge macroscopic consequences, how can artworks be constructed around this? And my first example, this is another way to see this, is scaling the micro, the meso, and the macroscopic level, and in how far all these levels can be addressed as artistic media and seen through the lens of biomedia, because this is a niche I'm focusing on. So the first case study of two I'm going to finish with is an artwork by a young Belgian artist, 28 years old. We had him as a student at one of the Symbiotica art and biotech workshops that have been organizing, and that was in this case part of the Stavanger Biennale as part of the Capital Culture Program in 2008 in Stavanger that I organized. And there were lots of students from RCA in London that have been using biotechnology more as a topic, and you know about Antine Dan's class of critical design in a certain way and building fictitious strategies of how to address topics of the mutant human and techno-scientific evolution. And they learned about lab work for the first time, and one of these artists is Tour van Baalen. And Tour van Baalen did a work that we exhibited also as part of the synthetic exhibition in the Vienna Museum in early spring. And the title of this work is Pigeon d'Or. And it's a nice example, to my opinion, because this art project uses design objects, interventions, narratives to explore the political implications of emerging technologies such as synthetic biology in our everyday lives. And it proposes to use pigeons as a platform and interface for synthetic biology in an urban environment. And very shortly to say, the project attempts to make pigeons defecate soap. So pigeons are shitting soap. So by concretely modifying the metabolism of bacteria that are naturally appearing in pigeons, synthetic biology here allows the artist to add no new functionality to animals that are commonly seen as flying rats and turning them into tools for urban disinfection. And in collaboration with a scientist from the Imperial College in London, the artist has designed special bacteria that, when fed to pigeons, turn the feces into a biological window soap, kind of glycerin-like substance. And it's created using biobricks, which are standardized genetic building blocks collected in the Registry of Standard Biological Parts that is set up by the MIT since 2003. And one biobrick is responsible for lowering the pH level in the bacteria, and the other makes bacteria express lipase, that is this grease-digesting enzyme. So what is interesting is that it's really, I mean, he's also designing this kind of landing platforms for pigeons to directly land and clean the windscreens. And this micro and macro scale art project addresses the ethical, political, environmental, safety-related consequences of synthetic biology. It asks also questions that are relevant to philosophical anthropology and would be very, very certainly be picked up by Plessner, I would say. Will we suddenly care for manipulated pigeon cells while usually we're trying to poison them without any remorse? Will we treat pigeons differently once they become useful for cleaning our cars? Is it dangerous to release products of synthetic biology into the environment? So it addresses question and engages directly into law. I mean, what does it mean to release such a pigeon? What does it mean to create a genetic organism? What does it mean to change the digestive system of a vermin? Once I touch it as a technological tool, ecologists are going to be set up. So it's a whole scope of questions, and it deals with xenobiology, ecology, and also it's seen as a post-anthropocentric approach to technology. Yeah, I will stop there, not to discuss this project any further. It's just one example. And so coming back very shortly as a Übergang to the second example, I claim that beyond biological subdisciplines that are at stake here, a more epistemological and a more holistic approach to synthetic biology is provided in offering a large panoply of challenges to philosophy, ecology, ethology, law, and the aesthetic object is very much determined by the very presence. I mean, because there is an organic entity that has agency that is involved, that makes us really feeling as being in front of a co-corporality, like in performance art in a certain way. Many of these biotech works or bio-art projects are really counting in this on this effect. And this effect, of course, is an effect of presence, and we know that in the remediation theory also, Walter and Grusin put up two mechanisms in the evolution of media, that is immediacy, that means that the media are trying to hide themselves away. They do like they were not there, so the medium is being looked through. So this is a tradition in a certain way of illusionism. And the other mechanism is to construct media that are renewed in the name of the real, but through a strategy of hypermediacy, where we emphasize that through media we get a better or more direct connection to the world. So the media is being looked at, and this I will exemplify with a second example, which is that of indexicality. Indexicality in the means of really stressing the very fact that the transmission or the articulation through a media itself is authentic. So this second case study I'm finishing with falls into this category, and you just stop me where you want, because then I'm going a bit into detail just in order to demonstrate how many disciplines could benefit from such projects, both in terms of research in producing such artworks, but also in terms of teaching. This is the only reason why I go a little bit into detail here. And please really stop me when you feel that it's going too far, right? But this is an art project which is also the result of a very intense interdisciplinary research involving genomics, criminal anthropology, physiognomy, photography, semiotics, post-colonial studies, and art history. And I'm talking about the artist Paul Van Oos, and I'm organized the first solo show of Paul's in Berlin at the Ernst Schering Foundation earlier this year, in which was a partner event to Transmediale. And Paul Van Oos is using indexical media used in contemporary art, and the most recent one is probably gel electrophoresis, which is a standard technique for DNA analysis that is used in molecular biology. And Van Oos here challenges the notion of so-called genetic fingerprinting. And here are examples from a work that is called the Latent Figure Protocol, which is based on making visible this banding patterns that you all know that are created by the gel electrophoresis process that is employed in DNA analysis. Just shortly how it works, employing a gel, an agarose gel and electric current, DNA samples, as we know, that are always negatively charged molecules, are electrically drawn to the other end, to the positive voltage end of the gel, and depending upon the molecular size, they create this smaller molecules travel faster than larger ones, so they stop at different locations, and therefore you have these patterns. It's only because of the size is different and they move faster or slower through the gel. And when digested by enzymes, so the sample produces banding patterns and can be fixed with ultraviolet light and be fixed. So the result is not an image of DNA, and that makes it indexical, but rather DNA as an image, which makes a large difference. And therefore constitutes, like Hans-Jörg Reinberg has already pointed out, a form of indexicality, because it is the actual parts of the sample that makes up the chromatogram directly. Of course, when it comes to the index, we know that in Pierce theory you have symbol, icon, and index. I'm not going into that now. But what is interesting about the index in Pierce theory is that there is a shared materiality between the signifier and the signified, and therefore the indexicality has provided authenticity, quote, to the imprint, to photography, and now to gel electrophoresis as a pseudo example of indexicality that in this work Paul Van Oos is being constructing. So he subverts the indexicality inherent to the very notion of a DNA fingerprint, which precisely is not an imprint, but just a trace of a body which has been manipulated through standard laboratory procedures and that needn't come to from the finger at all. Because, quote, Van Oos, the genetic fingerprint is often understood to be a single unique human identifier, and its complex banding patterns imagined as an unchanging sentence written by Mother Nature herself. which is not the case. It's the procedure which makes it up. So the DNA image is just cheating with trying to resemble something natural. So what Vonnoos does here is to create very iconic images, and not the banding patterns that were usually very abstract and everybody knows, but to create, by the means of synthesis, to use the analytic tool to synthesize, to reverse engineer the whole process, and therefore to create figurative images created not from unknown but from known DNA samples, and to generate iconic images with a symbolically highly charged motif such as ID 01, the copyright symbol, the chicken and egg question, or skull and crossbones. So these are the motifs that have been generated live. So the idea is to downgrade the scientific authority of the indexical and objective, or supposedly objective, DNA fingerprint to the status of the subjective portrait made by the artist's hand. Another project that we did at the Schering Foundation was called the Suspect Inversion Center, SIC. SIC is also an inversion of the CSI, so the cream sign in investigation, as the CSI effect. And here, Vonnoos undermines the notion of mechanical objectivity. And it was during 10 weeks a functional public laboratory where the audience could witness the live creation of a genetic fingerprint from well-known criminal cases, such as the banding patterns of the DNA profile of the alleged murderer and US American football star O.J. Simpson. But Paul Vonnoos reproduced exactly the DNA fingerprint of O.J. Simpson from his own DNA, live in the gallery and under the eye of the public. And the last work I'm just going to mention, and there are many media archaeological questions that are embedded here, and that also I only demonstrate in order to make you aware of the scope of questions, how many disciplines, how many research questions could be embedded in welcoming artists of this type to a university. This artwork is called Relative Velocity Inscription Device, and it makes also use of the classical fingerprint and photography in order to examine links between eugenics of the past and our day's genomics, and to ask whether racism has possibly moved to the molecular level. And this apparatus formally resembles an altar or a triple triptych, and in the center you have a race about race, in which the body is being erased. That means that gene fragments from the multiracial family of the artist of Jamaican descent himself run an absurd race against each other on this gel electrophoresis tray, and the race is supposed to determine the DNA's fitness by tracing the position on the gel. So the winner of each gel, of each race, however, changes at every race, because it's not telling us everything about the bodies, but about the molecular size from a specific variation. The media archaeological questions are very interesting, because when you look at this running figure, it's not just any running figure, but these red stick figures with rudimentary sequences of movement are, in fact, animated version of Edward Muybridge's Running Man. So, which is the fruit of dissection of a full movement, and which is reanimated here. So there is this notion of this reference to photographic motion, and reanimated bottom up something which has been dissected top down. It's a critique of genomics as well, to say if you build up the idea of a human body from genes, you will only get a kind of saccadic motion with noise. And we know, everybody knows, that if you induce noise in media art, that means that you are pointing to the very mediality of the device, be it sampling, scratching, or whatever. So it's very on the notion of reusing and referring to photography here. There's also, here you can see it better, a book, which is Rois Crossing in Jamaica, which is part of installation, which is from Davenport's 29 Studies, which is one of the most influent books on early eugenics. It was to prevent black-white hybrids, and Davenport was in fact the forerunner he was a follower of Francis Galton, the anthropologist and founder of the very discipline of eugenics. And in fact, the eugenics movement was based on the idea in the beginning of the fingerprint, in the sense that Francis Galton was also the originator of dactyloscopy. And the goal of his biometrical studies of papyri ridges of the finger was not to classify individuals, but to find differences between races. And what is interesting and what is not very known is that when the results were proving insightful, Galton was giving the fingerprint up, and it was used only afterwards as a tool for identification. And he was turning back to what he was called composite photography portraiture, that were produced by composites, by multiple exposures of individual portraits, blending them to a single image, and to have a kind of racial stereotype. So all this question of how indexicality was producing authenticity in the history of art, in order to stress how these scientific, artistic collaborations have also paved the way for misuse. In Van Noos, in this installation, brings them to the field of today's genomics, and really turning this technology upside down, he condenses the histories of media and science and places the DNA fingerprint in the history of miniaturization and the analysis of supposed essence. I want to close there, because I think that this biomedia art does not materialize as a standalone media, but that they appear in intermediate constellations that combine physical, optical, and even computational media. And in most cases, we have to do with media archaeological puzzles that have to be solved to track down the visible, but also the invisible, the technical, and the epistemic elements in a widely distributed mediality that produce semantic outputs via their very functions and materials. And this is something, as epistemic art, working with epistemological biomedia, was for me a way to question in how far this kind of niche could be interesting for looking at art and science collaborations within the context of academia. So, sorry for the niche, but I was coming from the general and really getting it together to one case study. Hopefully it made sense. So I brought the books as well, if you want to have more literature about this. There's a catalogue about the Berlin exhibition I bring tomorrow. There's a catalogue about the Vienna exhibition. And there's also a catalogue about the Skinterfaces project that was in 2008 opening Liverpool's years as a capital of culture in Liverpool in 2008. That is a book that I published. Mm-hmm.
Shall we kick off?
Yes, of course.
Let's kick off. Can you tell us about the discussion that has been sort of which is probably to follow in the catalogue, but within the scientific, between scientific world and the artistic world? I mean, what kind of issues are sort of raised by the scientists, and why do they feel that this is sort of burning issues? Do they discover something in them?
You mean the scientists
themselves? No, I mean the scientists themselves.
Well, I mean, there is, Reinberger says this very brilliantly in the catalogue that he have produced, when he tried to work on the Iconoclast exhibition with Peter Weibel and Bruno Latour at ZKM. he tried to make exactly the artwork happen that Paul Van Nuys is doing, but without knowing about him, and said, well, but we didn't find any scientists wanting to do that, because no scientist would be interested in telling about the media, but rather want to tell about the results. So it points to the blind spot of how knowledge is being produced, and that normally scientists include in the materials and methods sections at the end of the article. It was made this way, but not further questioning what the epistemic conditioning of this knowledge production actually is. So this is this insight, I think, that is then also interesting, because it comes down to an STS-like feature. Right? And then also, sometimes scientists find out about practices that they are just living with. For example, when we produced the Harlequin Code, which was Orlong's first biotechnological artwork, and that is also portrayed in this catalog, she was really freaking out to see that in the US, the ATCC cell data bank classifies cells that you can buy on the internet and that we acquired for the art project among racial criteria. So you can order a skin cell from a black skin donor that has cancer. And it's Caucasian, it's African, and you have this classification. So racism is coming back through the back door every time. It's the same with population genetics. And this is, by the way, a prize that we just gave as a media prize also to this project by Paul Van Nuys about population genetics. And how far, when you have to define the gene pool in order to get this probability calculating calculations done, that makes genomic data relevant, you have to go back to criteria that we thought that were overcome, which is still racial criteria. I mean, there's many of these questions, I think, that make scientists aware of evidences of the praxis, which is not that evident.
Pick up on your question, Pierre, and perhaps it was something that was evoked earlier. I'm a little concerned about scientists being taxed with lack of awareness of their epistemological frameworks as a generalization. Mm-hmm. And I was just looking up Karen Barad, quantum physicist, who I think at the moment is contributing some of the most original thinking about the apparatus and the dynamic reconfiguration of a representational, or she would say a non-representational universe. She's a scientist who, as far as I can see, manifests more epistemological awareness than most people one would run across, whether they're scientists or artists. So I just think, what's her name, the feminist who's working on the biologist, the famous woman.
Yeah, Ellen Fox Keller.
Yeah, Fox Keller. I mean, these people have a massive, they are, if we were come up again with the trading zones and the name droppings and the statistical mappings, I think that Fox Keller and Barad and a few others would rate quite highly. They're probably up for the next generation equivalents of
Brad Duffy is first.
Well, yeah, of course. So I'm just concerned that I think there are some very robust scientific contributors to thinking about epistemological premises and frameworks, and I just don't want that to be overridden or overlooked. Yeah.
Well, for me, that one aspect of this is the terrain that art acts on when it's kind of wants to go into dialogue deliberately with science. And the examples that you've shown are ones where the artists are really getting their hands dirty, if you like, and are not doing, kind of initially, not doing projects about science, but they're doing projects within scientific apparatuses. You know, I'm trying to think about the notion of the medium that you're bringing in. where the medium in this case becomes the whole apparatus of experimental genetics in this case. It's not going anywhere, sorry.
Well, the interesting thing in Zeitler's theory about the media is that there are five steps. The first is just environment, material, machine, technical object, institution. So it goes from, if you want, from Lamarck to Luhmann, right? So it broadens up the notion of the mediality completely. And that's why, for me, it's a powerful tool to destructure this and to get it back just to communicative functions between entities. But it has to do, and in Zeitler's theory, it's interesting because he compares the first step of the environment to the last step of a very complex institution, which is in a certain way the same. And in systems theory, I mean, it's interchangeable. One medium can become a form, and the form as well can serve as a medium as well. So that's basic Luhmannism. So, but it's picked up there.
Can I ask a really simple art question? I was wondering. Sorry. Yeah. I was wondering about the intradisciplinary citation involved in the artwork. For example, your Tour van Balen, I was thinking of the piece Urban Eyes by Markus Kirchen. You see Angelsleva, do you know this piece? It was about 5 years ago. There was an exhibition, a competition called Fused Space, organized in Holland by a bunch of organizations. And in this project, pigeons were fed with, the pigeon feed included RFID tags, mm-hmm. and their movements through the city were then tracked on closed circuit television. And I was just thinking maybe there is also a self-referentiality within the art world, because then you have Beatrice da Costa liberating pigeons, and they become pollution detectors, and so, you know, there's this harnessing of a species on the one hand, but there's also a remediation, remobilization of an existing artistic reference or vector. It's, I think, it becomes a kind of a citational system.
Yeah. Yeah? That's very true. But I mean, if you're sitting in juries like we do, I mean, you see that we have one bin for the geolocalization art, and you have one bin for the second life bin, life art bin, and then you have a pigeon art bin, you know.
Actually, the word bins sound disparaging. Some of it's good.
I'm not quite sure if I got it right. The pigeons, they could do what you described. They were genetic engineered.
The pigeons are not genetically engineered.
Okay.
The bacteria are. So
yeah.
It's a multi-step project, and it goes one step further each time. And each step has consequences on very different players. So the next step is to go to the law department of the university. The first step is to create the bacteria. Second is to test how much time it takes to replace the bacterial flora in the digestive tube of the pigeon with the transgenic bacteria. That has been proved. It takes 2 weeks, something like that. And the next step is to actually really get them into the pigeons,
mm-hmm.
and to release them. And each step involves another kind of research. And at each step, a micro or macro scale problem is being solved each time, but once after another. Yeah. And that's interesting, I think, for me there, because for the first step, you need the genetic engineer. That's done. Okay, for the second one, you need somebody who knows something about, I don't know, but invasive species, or who knows something about xenobiology, or who knows something about dissemination of E. coli bacteria in the environment. You need a lawyer. For each step, you need a different process.
But the aim is to liberate these pigeons one day. Yes, that was my
question.
Oh, no, the aim is to have clean windows.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the real goal.
Yeah, of course.
There's a nice, how boring. I mean, what is the Austrian song which is very popular? Tauben vergiften im Park.
I'm reluctant to speak like this, but I've been at the presentation at the Ars Electronica this year of that gold Nika piece with the horse piece, and I've seen many of these bio art pieces at Ars Electronica, Next Life and stuff like that. Mm. Seen a lot of that, but to say to distinguish this from science. What I felt when I've seen this presentation was that there are deep myths retold. It was really a very mythical, earthly atmosphere when this artist told about her experiences getting blood from a black horse. Very, very mythical. And I said to myself, no German would ever be allowed to do such a piece. No German at all. So it is. We have a new place for really dark myths now.
Well, I have to be honest to say that I curated this project.
Yeah.
And we did it in Slovenia. I'm in Germany. I mean.
Yeah. So this is a very problematic, at least problematic aspect of work like that. You have in science, you have all this cooling down by scientific methodology, but now you open up a field of myths, put it shortly, that are really very problematic. So what is the partnership or the correspondence to science? Is it borrowing the objectivity to be able to do myths again? It seemed to me to be like that a bit.
I think there is through art historical contamination, very often, a tendency to read these works primarily through the connection to myth as a feature, as a topic. So you have the golem and so on, and people like Hans Horst Bredekamp are very much responsible for this kind of reading of techno art pieces. And to put them in a line that is a continuation of this myth. And it was not deliberate that, for example, I've wanted to focus here on somebody like Paul Bernoos, who says, okay, yeah, I'm dealing with genetic engineering, but it's not about the golem, it's not about hybridization, it's not about old Greece, and it's not about the antique, and it's about creating evidence and authenticity for political purposes that I want to dismantle. So to have a media focus on it that is epistemological in the very sense of mixing how the technology feeds the actual myth, if you want, but this would be a Kittlerian approach, das a priori des Technischen, and how this works together, rather to see that the technology is in the service of the myth. I would contradict that. I mean, I know what you want to say, right? And in the special case of the French group, it's interesting because there is research in ethnographic data by this group done since very many years. They have been to Africa. Benoît Mangin has been running the art center, the French art center in Cameroon for some years, working very much with local communities and ecological art forms. They did experiment extensively with Iboga. Marie Laval-Janté comes from a family of scientific researchers, but at the same time is into shamanism. So there is a mix, yeah, in this case. I agree with you. But not in every case. That's why we agreed also, Andreas and myself, when we were trying to delimitate what kind of examples can be useful to in this context. So what examples to talk about, and the others which opened up new fields, as you say, to let them for the table discussion with some bottles of wine.
wonder if we assume, I mean, I kind of try to follow up Andreas' thought about the artist stepping into a kind of new communicative field, which is science, what happens afterwards, and or within that process, or how that can be productive. And I wonder to what extent, if we assume that there are scientists in whatever region of science who are reflective about the mediality of what they're doing and about their epistemological tools, and that especially in fields like bio art, other fields as well, there are artists who try to appropriate scientific methods, insights, and kind of the tools of science for what they are doing. Are there examples in this field where you have a transgression really of the role of the artist and the scientist, where we kind of get beyond this traditional role model? Mm-hmm. Because to some extent, from what I've seen, a lot of those examples, I mean, there is an extension now of the dialogue, but now you have more scientists writing in art catalogs, kind of what they rather prior in earlier times would publish as a scientific paper, and so there's a closer integration, but the role model is not really
broken. There are examples. I mean, it's not because you have a technique and this technique is so broad. I mean, it's not because talking of biology, it's like talking about physics, and physics then employs all kind of semiconductors. I mean, it's so broad, you know. So in ecological research, I mean, yeah, the model is broken, let's say, by Brendan Ballanger, who does his ecological art projects that he's been doing with Arts Catalyst for some time, using amphibian species as biological indicators, ecological indicators. And he co-signs scientific papers with the scientist, and the scientist gets new research directions, because there has been a tendency to believe that amphibian deformation is mainly caused by heavy metals and chemical substrates. And they have been carrying out field works in the Yorkshire Park in England that seems to contradict this very popular scientific idea. And there have been many papers that are co-signed now by the scientist and Brendan Ballanger himself. Zbigniew Upsiuta is a biological artist from Cologne, from Poland, but he was in Cologne for 25 years without any input. And once he got out of Germany, it's imploding and exploding his practice, and he's now building up a new faculty of biological architecture at RPA in Troy. I mean, and the issues then are exactly the same that you have been addressing earlier with copyright. So who is the inventor? If I open up this center like he does in Troy, and I'm developing this prototype, who does the prototype belong to? And can I still publish this under the name of art, because there's heavy money that is involved then there. And these models exist as well. I think it's not dependent at all on the technology, whether it's physics, informatics, or whether it's biology. I think that we are just focusing on this bio art as a very, very superficial level today, because it's provocative and it has this gut effect, right? But it doesn't mean that automatically the scientific problems in art and science context may be different because of this.
But Jens, do you think that...
You know, I'm thinking about the biomedia as new media, kind of capital N, capital M, if you like. And I'm thinking of these examples from the computation lab in Madrid in the late 60s, where they were just trying to figure out what those computers meant, like other technically motivated experimentation that would happen around electronic and digital media, interactive media, in the 90s. Do you think that the biomedia are like a new medium that cause some sort of irritation? Maybe it's more, the gut reaction is stronger because it's so weird, whereas, you know, in the 60s, the gut reaction against art being made by computers was similarly radical and, you know, met with, you know, probably somehow comparable animosity. You think that there's a new artistic medium? Can it, you know, is it possible to package what you're proposing?
I mean, even if I've been talking to Jan Muggeberg yesterday, because we were at a conference together in Bochum not very much time ago, because what he's studying at Lüneburg about the chemical computing and the early Gordon Pask models, the 60s and so on. I mean, there are artists working with this. For example, Roman Kirchner's work, Roots, is very much a translation of the chemical computer of Gordon Pask that he tried to build up, meaning that you would push even Turing's idea a little bit further in the very sense that a computer would material transform itself while calculating, right? And there is not a lot of artistic work done yet on biocomputing, cell computing, because it's very early. Huh? But why not? No? I can see this happening, but it could go in very different directions too. I mean, it could go more to the nano, and it very much depends on where the money goes, where the funding structures goes. And this is one of the main reasons we did all this synthetic biology project in Vienna at the Natural History Museum, which was embedded into the framework of a festival, which was called Biofiction. And it's because the notion of synthetic biology is 100 years old, and it's coming from Stéphane Leduc, and his book La Biologie Synthétique, and it's 1910, right? And now everybody is crazy about synthetic biology because it's a new convergent research field you can get money for. And this is a moment for epistemology to get in and maybe to work in a critical way around this idea. And there will be a conference about art and synthetic biology at the Berlin Brackenbrandenburg Academy of the Science at 8 and 9 December, if you are a world in Berlin at this moment, because it's a hype, and you use an old world which is becoming new again, and it's I think it's a funding issue. And if you come from the American or Anglo-Saxon definition of what synthetic biology is, you are completely on a different track than the European notion of what synthetic biology is, which is more integrative, which is more about origins of life research. It's much more also integrating protocells, and it's not just biobricks like the iGEM competition every year, where you have a creative input from artists fitting into this competition by young engineering students. So I think also the cultural impetus here is to use these dynamics to jump on then in order to first raise epistemological awareness, and second maybe to even to be able to redirect the very evolution and this cultural flow. Maybe it's a bit ambitious, but
so I have a question related to that, because before I've been referring to this mythology that is needed in order to activate capital for research, for artistic endeavors or so. And now we have this sort of merging point of a new, relatively new field in science, and then you bring in the artist. Does that mean that you need to encounter a certain ratio of shallowness in a new field of research that demands or that creates a demand for artists? Or how's that?
Well, I think that's a question also. I mean, the iGEM competition is not for artists, for example, but it's about creativity and innovation, right? And I have more problem with creativity and innovation.
My question was aimed at this. Is there a certain, a fuzziness that is needed for people to project into and buy into projects that would need artists, because maybe science is just not advanced enough by now? Or is it more that they really need to activate the creative energies of the artists as symbolic capital, or how do you see that?
I feel that it's more the other way around, that there are every time a group of artists to go for the newest tool. I mean, it's a reflex, right? Mm-hmm. And then it depends on how you direct this and what kind of cultural debate you generate. I do not see that there's a need of industry to have artists to promote synthetic biology at all. I think it's... No, not at all. And it's really the other... The critical thing about is to say, why should art always use new technologies and new tools? Does it produce new formal qualities or aesthetic qualities because you use a new tool? That's a more relevant question, I think. And it's not true, because 99% of these new artworks are probably extremely shallow, right? Mm-hmm. And we had this discussion on the Yasmin list on Art and Science. I don't know if you're aware of this list going on. The Yasmin is a discussion forum. You know it probably. Yasmin has been initiated by Leonardo, the Art and Science journal, by Roger Malina, and topics like art and biology, do artists need PhD, and so on, that have been archived for years now, and it's in many languages, and it's in a Greek website, it's Yasmin. We had this discussion on Yasmin, for example, on synthetic biology, whether you could actually do a show without only using synthetic biology really as a tool by using biobricks. And you would end up with, I don't know, maybe 10 works, right? And it wouldn't probably be very interesting. So this determinism by a new technology is very a critical point. And again, this was my idea to say, okay, if you do something about this topic, then we have to step back in history and to say, where does it come from? Which different techniques are involved? Which different histories of science are involved to convert to something that is now getting a discipline? And what role could art play, pushed into the context and letting artists out in this field to, as catalyzers in a way, to not just uncritically stand there and being fascinated what a biobrick can do when you reprogram an E. coli bacterium. Mm-hmm. There have been other cases, and for this year there was one prize at Ars Electronica from a group from Bangalore, and they created an artistic biobrick that when transplanted and activating, I don't remember exactly what cell it was, that it was the bacteria was producing a smell that was the smell after heavy rainfall in India. So it is a very nostalgic and a very romantic piece of work by 25 years old art students, but having access to the lab. It also means that the cultural discourse about manipulation of life is very different if you look from it from an Asian perspective, from an Indian Bangalore perspective, or when you look from it from a German perspective with our very church history.
In this case, how would you place progressiveness? I mean, on the one hand, you have progressiveness according to the exploration of new media, of new technologies. But on the other hand, in your example, you have an artistic statement which is completely reactionary. So, you know.
Sally, you want to...
Yeah,
and then I would like to suggest a break. We take a coffee and then go into Martin Warnke's final presentation for today.
Yeah, I was really interested in your question because actually I was working a couple of years ago with a colleague who's she's a genomics specialist from UCL at the Cancer Research Institute there, and she's somebody who's very interested in interdisciplinarity. She's a Fox Keller disciple and really interesting person. And she was saying that in her area, that what was lacking as a scientist was the audacity to think and leap across the scales of computer modelling that she was engaged in. And so she was very keen to engage with artists, and we did some work together, we published a piece together. We got thrashed, actually, at Duke University. They couldn't bear... They asked for interdisciplinary groups, but what that meant, actually, was that they wanted a musician and a dancer, or they wanted a, you know, it was... But they didn't expect a genomic specialist with a sort of a, I don't know, whatever I am. And so she, I think in some ways, would go along with your suggestion that in certain fields there might be sufficient instability with respect to the frameworks and the epistemological premises for the kinds of artistic acrobatics, the risk-full leaps.
It almost seems like a sort of panic reaction, like the horror vacui.
Sorry?
Like some sort of horror vacui reaction.
Yeah, but what she did really interestingly, I'm looking at the paper that we, well, this isn't the, what we finally published, but she said that computer modelling is a way of representing the models we build in our minds through scientific thought. And she talks about computer modelling and simulation could be seen as highly skillful techno-informatic forms of myth-making and myth enactment. So what she was doing was swinging the problem around and saying that actually the scientists involved in sophisticated computer modeling processes were engaged in a very creative form of myth making. They just weren't necessarily owning up to it, but that she wanted to engage with artists who were positing themselves as myth makers in order to try and more productively challenge the two ways of thinking. So I think your question is a really interesting one. At what point and by what communities, if we try and look for a strict historicity and say, oh, this is a new field, for the first 2 years, it's going to be a good deal, let's gravitate towards this, I think that's going to be making a big mistake, because it's going to be idiosyncratic as a function of communities and different... Yeah. Mm. But it's an interesting question, yeah.
Okay, no. I think we need a break.
Oh,
go ahead, just Pierre.
No. The you mentioned the fifth stage with the institutions, and the biomedia institute. Could you expand a little bit on that? What would that sort of imply? Mm. Are we leaving the lab? Are we going out into the experiments or the social experiments, so to speak?
Well, the fifth stage, as institutions being thought as organisms, is already the Maturana and Varela reference that Luhmann is picking up in the biological discourse itself. It's the self-organizing paradigm, autopoiesis, self-structuring, are ideas that are coming from biology, and they have been placed into this realm of the fifth stage, if you want. I mean, and how far you need to manipulate that. The Simondon model of individuation would be a correspondency to this whole line of how you get to individuation on the molecular level through the formation of individuation as becoming indivisible, which is what individuation means, and then the individuation then on the psychosocial level, including the inheritance of not only cultural production but also cultural reproduction. So I feel that this would be the Simondon model is probably very interesting at this stage. I don't know, but he's coming from physics and moving to biology, which is another one aspect of individuation. Huh?
He also has a very extensive piece of writing that tends to be overlooked on aesthetics, and what precisely aesthetics? Talks about the kind of the magic quantum leap, transductive. Mm-hmm. Movement from that that aesthetics is precisely the opposite of the contained and the discrete. It's what leaps beyond, and what it's the notion of contagion that you get in Thrift. But I think that Simondon's writings on art and ritual and the non-scientific are incredibly interesting.